Thank you so much. So we have a decent amount of time now for questions. So when we can go one at a time initially, but if there are a lot of questions, we can also take them in a batch. Comments are also welcome. Doesn't have to be just questions, of course. Move over here. Any initial? Issues to raise? And I, if you want to think for a little bit longer, I've got several. Do you have one there?
I have one.
Go ahead, please.
Yeah, it's for I really enjoyed the presentation, definitely. I mean, I'm not very familiar with Blanqui, right? So you'll have to correct me if my observations are wrong or anything. But it sounded as if Blanqui's category of the proletariat is in some sense a political abstraction. I don't know if you would agree with that characterization of abstraction, but I'm going to put it out there to preface my question, which is that if it's an abstraction, I wonder to what extent is it capable of being internally differentiated? Because it sounded as if it is only along sort of national lines in some of the quotes that you gave. This is like the crux of my question is to what extent is his category of the proletariat capable of being internally differentiated? Because for me, to contrast the merit of Marx's category of the proletariat is that it's equally as broad as Blanqui's. Mm-hmm. It's equally as broad, but it's got the added merit as a historically specific social ontology of capitalist valorization. It provides the sort of social determinations of that proletarian condition, right? So we can understand then the proletariat as sort of constituting itself in processes of exploitation, but also referring to employed and unemployed, right? I mean, it's basically a broad category of being separated from the means of reproducing itself. And so, yeah, my question is to what extent then is Blanqui's category capable of being internally differentiated in a way, you know, that we don't have that critique of political economy underneath.
What do you mean by internally differentiated?
I mean, like, so we have, you know, the people, we have a spectrum of privilege and things like this, but these are all sort of abstracted from, you know, particular, you know, social experiences within society, right? I mean, there's, you know, different kinds of ways in which one is experiencing domination, right? I mean, it's
sure, yeah,
not just all under an umbrella category of, the oppressed or something like this, right? I mean, so, and I think it's an important topical question too, right? Because often in, you know, contemporary social movements, you know, you get appeals to these kinds of generalizing categories of the 99% or
exactly,
the people, the citizens. And this is a real, you know, internal problem to these struggles, right? Because then they, this risks sort of glossing over what are, you know, real concrete differentiated experiences of forms of domination. So I'm just wondering to what extent Blanqui's concept then can sort of begin to sort of get to those specifics, maybe. Mm.
Yeah, thanks. Really,
yeah, thank you.
Really good comment. I think I'd have to think through it. I mean, I agree with you that I think what's interesting, what seemed interesting to me at least, was reading a lot of these critiques that I kind of glossed over at the beginning, which come from a supposedly very like orthodox Marxist position, and using this as a kind of critical purchase on why his can be dismissed as imprecise, also the kind of reasons I gave. But actually, if you look at, like in the manifesto, for example, it's like the idea that tendentially there will be this kind of sharp reduction into two separate groups, proletarian bourgeois, and it's the kind of that the politics behind that brutal reductive move that like can, which is why I kind of suggested at the beginning that although perhaps there are certain points at which there is a certain differentiation between Blanqui and Marx or Marx's perspective. On the other hand, there are points at which there is a certain amount of crossover. It's like, well, where can you find the political similarities between the two. So I think, yeah, that was kind of in the background and something that could be developed further is the point at which this is a kind of conscious political move that isn't just limited to Blanqui, but I think his is a particularly kind of, and as Peter was saying at the beginning, the force with which he seeks to impose it, and in every situation. Yeah, and on the point about Chuck, I think...
Can I just add, because I think it's a really good question, and it's also a relatively common criticism of Blanqui. Yeah. And I think one problem is that he doesn't have a concept of the petite bourgeoisie, actually. That's a bigger problem, arguably, which looms very large in Marx's analysis of 1848, of course. That, you know, how do you build a class alliance between the emerging, still minoritarian proletariat and this numerically larger and vacillating, uncertain, precarious, and broadly reactionary, but, you know, win-overable petite bourgeoisie, big problem for Lenin later and so on. And in fact, all the way through the revolution, you know, that will play out all through the 20th century revolutionary cycles too. And I think, given that category, the peasantry, the petite bourgeoisie, is a major issue in 1848 in France through to Napoleon's coup. And Blanqui doesn't, I think, engage with that in a way that gives it the concreteness that Marx spends quite a lot of time analyzing. And he doesn't look at, for example, I think he takes a lot of it largely for granted, but how is it that petite bourgeoisie is divided and controlled and dominated and so on. On the other hand, though, it's just two quick things to add. One is that he does talk about exploitation, for example, the proletariat as exploited in broadly a kind of surplus, but sort of a something like a labor theory of value approach in an early text from 1834 called "Those Social Wealth Should Belong to Those Who Make It." I think that's how we've translated it, which is on our website, and it's a few pages long only. But you get something there, that basically there's a class of people who extract, who make people work for longer than they're paid, something like that.
Right.
And that excess is the basis for the wealth of that exploiting class. But for Blanqui, that's totally obvious. Like, for him, that's just elementary experience. Anybody who's exploited knows exactly what that is. The idea that you would spend four volumes, you know, working your way through that, you know, is something that would have seemed bizarre to him.
Right.
It would have been, in a way, a kind of a waste of time. So in that sense, the proletariat, there is something that distinguishes it in the sense of the way that it's exploited. On the other hand, where he is very similar to Marx, I think, is the idea that it's an anticipatory majority. That, you know, when Marx says the proletariat is the vast majority of humanity in the manifesto, of course that's not yet the case, but it will become the case inexorably. Lenin does the same thing when he talks about the development of capitalism in Russia. And Blanqui, too, I think, that as things progress, as things clarify, then this we will be in this polarized, dualist situation that Philippe described very well, I think. And in that sense, it is a logic of anticipatory concentration. Paris is important because it's already happened. It'll happen slowly but surely, inexorably in the rest of the country. It'll happen in the rest of Europe. It'll happen ultimately in the rest of the world. Again, I think he sort of takes that somewhat for granted. And there, it's both anticipating, I think, Marx and Lenin. It's also, though, maybe more importantly, very, for me, very resonant with the logic that Robespierre and Marat and a few others use in 1792. Let's end this quickly. Because there, same criticism, in the run-up to 10th of August, so the second revolution in Paris where they overthrow the monarchy, the decisive moment of the French Revolution, the reactionary critique, or the moderate revolutionary critique, is you guys who have just mounted this insurrection in Paris, you're only a minority of people. You're just a clique of sans-culottes, you know, people in a few neighborhoods of Paris. Who gives you the right to speak for the whole of the people? It's a bit like saying, you know, how do you differentiate this category of the people? And that's one position. Same people who will say you can only decide the fate of the king through an appel au peuple, you know, through a kind of plebiscite. And that argument will be taken up by the Girondins when they try to think of how to draft the constitution of 1793. And the counter-argument that the sans-culottes themselves use, that Robespierre and Marat use, is no, in practice, when it comes to the question of sovereignty, which is fundamentally about power and force and command, it is always concentration both in time, in other words, in a moment of insurrection, and not a drawn-out process of political consultation and so on, and also in terms of space, in terms of where are the weak points? Where are we strong? Where is the enemy weak? Where can we prevail? It comes down to at this bridge, at that firing point, at these houses on a barricade, etc. And that logic is then a kind of, there is an actor which happens to be these thousands of people in Paris at this time who are ready to act, who have the weapons, who have the organization, and who can legitimately posit themselves as the concentrate of the people as a whole. And that's his logic of the proletariat too, I think. And it's also that of Marx. I think it's really important that on that point, they're actually, when it comes to political resolve, you know, the proletariat for Marx is also, in addition to the obvious economic dimension, the actor that, unlike the petty bourgeoisie, has a kind of political psychology based on determination. Resolve, resoluteness, clarity. You see it very strongly, I think, in his political analyses. But I'll shut up there and take some. So, Eric, did you have a question? And one there, and Ian. We'll take three.
When your two communications makes me think, is the originality of Blanqui, one of the originalities of Blanqui, which could be considered as a weakness, but maybe makes him more modern, is the little place he gives to economical problems. At the great difference of Marx.
Yes.
Economy, as we are assumed to think about it today, for him it's nothing. It's obvious, as you say it. The guy which is exploited, he doesn't need treaties to understand what exploitation is.
Right. Rancière says the same thing. He's very like Blanqui that way. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Good question.
Alors que paradoxalement, je continue en français, alors que paradoxalement, son frère est un économiste.
Oui.
His brother, Adolphe, was a very prominent economist, Blanqui's brother.
Mm-hmm. Prominent. Important.
Prominent.
Ah oui, très
yes.
Important.
Liberal.
and a liberal
economist as well.
Yeah.
Who became slightly ashamed of his brother.
I think more than that.
I thought he was nice.
Uh-huh. Adolphe? Oh, he thought Auguste was. Mm.
Yeah.
Should we take a couple more questions and then do you want to, it'd be good to address that directly. But maybe we'll take two more because Ian and, Ian, do you want to go first?
Yes, I wondered to what extent Blanqui, if at all, considered the question of the distinction between skilled and unskilled workers. Mm. Distinction that, for example, Michael Somminger, talking about the late 18th century, makes what I think is a very interesting distinction between people who make things and people who make things. So on the one hand, you've got people who make saddles or wigs or whatever, who are generally people who've served an apprenticeship, who have a considerable skill. And then you have people like dockers, meat porters, water carriers, and so on, who simply sweat a lot and carry heavy weights around. Now, my recollection is, and I'm open to correction, that Blanqui's organisation in 1839 was actually based on membership of particular trades, you know, that you had a group of workers from a particular skill and so on. So presumably these were people who had, acquired a skill, presumably through apprenticeship or something of the sort. And I wonder to what extent Blanqui confronted the question of the differentiation between the skilled worker and the unskilled worker.
Yeah, that's a good question. And Doug?
I was going to say, Blanqui, his definition of the proletariat, as you pointed out, could be considered, you know, vague, abstract. I think it's also important to point out that the proletariat, as we would understand it, or as Marx would, was still in its formation, as E.P. Thompson says, it's still in its making at this point. And as perhaps vague and abstract as his conception was, it was probably no more vague and abstract than those of, say, the utopian socialists or others. But what Blanqui does that they don't do is he's looking to form the proletariat into a political subject, into a political actor, whereas the utopian socialists are more concerned about appealing to kids and industrialists for reforms as opposed to declaring open warfare upon them. And that's a major distinction. And Blanqui, in The Proletariat of Paris and Leading the Nation, it does prefigure, in a certain sense, Marx's conceptions in 1848, which is not just the proletariat leading, but it's something he calls the democracy. It's also addressed not just, I believe, in the various addresses to the Communist League. It's the proletariat as the leading class, allied with the peasantry and the petty bourgeois, but clearly Marx conceives of the proletariat as that leading class. And this can also anticipate Lenin and Gramsci, you know, hegemony in the democratic or the socialist revolution, if you want.
Yeah, I agree. Is it a very similar, is it along similar lines, or should we answer these, Mitch?
Well, actually, it's along similar
okay,
lines.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, because, you know, a question that I don't think any of us are addressing, you know, in any of the talks is, who is he writing to and for? Because, for example, when Philippe, when you mentioned with Bernstein's critique about the numbers in Blanqui, he's addressing himself, he's not writing theoretical texts, as you said. I mean, who makes the soup, should eat it, is pretty much all you need to know. And so to look for, you know, really profound analyses and works that are meant to inspire people to action is looking for the wrong thing. So like for Bernstein to criticize Blanqui for, you know, the numbers not holding up on the analysis, I don't think that he was like, Blanqui wasn't worrying about whether this number ends up correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was aimed at getting people to move. And so there's a whole different thing. You know, was Blanqui a man of action who wrote or a writer who acted? And I don't know that any of us, and you know, actually Dominique, maybe, you know, you could address, you know, that best of all of us. I mean, it might be silly to try and decide which way it was, but it's really important if we're gonna talk about his writings to know which was the more essential.
Mm.
So
pour qui écrit-il et est-ce que c'est un homme d'action qui est aussi écrivain ou est-ce que c'est plutôt un écrivain qui est également un homme d'action? Mais si par exemple il écrit pour faire mobiliser les gens, pour les pousser à l'action, alors il ne faut pas attendre des raffinements théoriques. Stéphane, do you have a question as well? Okay. Why don't we try and answer those? Okay.
Alors, je ne sais pas si je répondrai totalement à ta question, mais tu me reprendras. Je pense que Blanqui écrit, quand il écrit dans les journaux déjà.
So often he's writing in newspapers.
Donc ça c'est important, il écrit pour éduquer le peuple, tout simplement. Je crois que ça c'est important. Il faut, alors le nombre de journaux, j'en ai cité que quelques-uns, mais le nombre des journaux qu'il essaie de faire sont quand même importants. Après 48, il y a Candide, il y a Ni Dieu ni Maître, il y a une quantité de journaux. Donc il écrit déjà dans des journaux et pour instruire.
So he's writing to educate, to instruct, to fare propaganda, you know, to do propaganda, and he's writing often in newspapers. So the Liberator is one that we mentioned here, 1834, but particularly after 1848, he's involved in launching several newspapers, Candide, Ni Dieu ni Maître, various others, and these are engaged militant, but you know, mass market newspapers.
Le seul ouvrage où on peut s'interroger, c'est effectivement L'éternité par les astres.
Yeah, the one question where the question of authorship of intended readership is different is his little book, notorious largely by the way because of Walter Benjamin's work on it, is Eternity by the Stars, and there the readership is indeed different.
Et je voulais signaler aussi que toutes ces archives ont été brûlées. Celle du Mont Saint-Michel, qui était très très importante, il l'a beaucoup regrettée, mais elles ont été brûlées par sa mère pour justement qu'on ne retrouve rien, qu'on ne trouve pas de traces, pour brouiller les traces de la police. Donc certainement qu'on a beaucoup de choses qui nous échappent.
And unfortunately, so his whole, this is a really a tragic thing. Blanqui's papers from the 1830s and 40s, particularly after 1839, were burned by his mother when he's arrested after the failed insurrection of 1839. He's put in prison in Mont Saint-Michel, where he almost dies. It's a horrendous sequence. His wife dies and so on. And to protect him from further police prosecution, his mother burns all of his papers of that period. And that was a very substantial archive and might well have contained a great deal of more theoretically refined material. So we've lost that. Even so, I should just say that the book in the collection of works that Dominique edited a few years ago now, so it's just called Oeuvre Volume 1, which was going to be the one of the first of the 10, it's still, that's up to 1848, and it's still a very big book. It's about 800, you know, 700 pages long. So there's still quite a lot of material, and there would have been vastly more. So we have that.
Est-ce que tu peux adresser la question, est-ce que tu as compris un peu la question de l'économie, alors Ian a demandé, est-ce que Blanqui fait une distinction entre des ouvriers qui font des emplois différents, par exemple les artisans, les maîtres artisans, ceux qui font des choses, qui créent par exemple des objets, et ceux qui les font déplacer.
Non, pas de différence. Simplement, je rajouterais aussi quelque chose sur l'économie politique, par exemple. Pourquoi est-ce qu'il ne s'intéresse pas aux économistes ou qu'il ne se lance pas dans des théories économiques c'est simplement que ce sont tous des économistes libéraux.
Yeah. So no, he doesn't. As far as you know,
ça n'intéresse pas, monsieur.
He doesn't talk about distinctions of kinds of work, really. And why does he not? Why does he not bother more? Why does he not engage more with economists and political economy as it was? Well, because they were almost exclusively liberal economists, and they're just not people that he wants to argue with or engage with.
C'est pour ça qu'il se fâche avec son frère.
Yeah, and that's why he breaks with his brother.
To add on the question of skilled and unskilled, I mean, and he often he has no distinction, but in fact, he goes even further to say that. Ultimately, even if you are a skilled worker, so I think this is in the text Communism, the Future of Society, even the most skilled labourers can still be the most ignorant and the most dominated and exploited people if they don't have the political consciousness to understand the logic of society as presently constituted. And this is the point in that text as well. He also says it's not to use skill and manual labor as a category through which to understand humanity and humanity's achievements is insufficient, and uses this comparison where even in nature they kind of emulate the greatest achievements of mankind in terms of what animals can do and their manipulation of material. So that category of comparison isn't really adequate for him. It's in terms of what humans are capable intellectually is the defining feature of mankind, and yeah. That's the central category through which he then. So it's all very well being a skilled laborer, but if you kind of don't have the intelligence or the enlightened intelligence to appreciate the underlying logic of society, then you're just as depraved as the most backward peasant in Britain.
Yeah, that's right. He doesn't distinguish between kinds of manual labor or really distinguish between manual and quote-unquote intellectual labor either. I mean, he knows there's the difference, but what interests him most of all is people who are déclassés, who because workers who are educated or educated people who work or who find a way to escape their prescribed role. In that sense, again, it's very Rancièrean. It's much more about déclassement than classification, I'd say, or differentiating different ways. Other questions or comments? We haven't maybe addressed fully the question of economics, I wonder, but maybe we'll come back to it. Yeah, at the back.
Yeah, I was just wondering about this, the analytical side of the concept of the proletariat and that political. Like when he was, like you said, that he said that like he's a professional proletariat. In a way, is there this kind of like idea that actually the proletariat is like in a way is that becoming conscious of or becoming political of the people or whatever? I don't know. Kind of sounded like that a little bit. Is there something like that there?
I mean, the play on that is so it's in this trial and the judge. I didn't have to explain it properly. The judge says, "What's your?" What's your profession? Well, the problem is, he says, so there are two...
Yeah, there's profession, yeah.
Right, so there are two different exchanges. There's one at the beginning of December 1831, when the judge says, "What's your profession?" And he responds, "A proletariat." And the judge says, "That's not a proletariat." And he says, "Well, if that's
not a profession.
If that's not a profession, then I don't have a profession." And then it's later in January 32 when the judge asks him the same question again, but uses the word état and not profession, which broadly means the same thing. But in terms of Rancière's analysis, as he says himself, like, everything turns on the word profession, right? And so when Bronchi responds, it's the profession of 30 million people who live from their labor. It's the profession belonging to a group, a profession of faith, in fact.
So
it's a kind of pedantic point, but there's actually a slight differentiation. But nonetheless, it's the idea of...
employed, in a way, by... Or, like, not employed, but, like, but he's...
No, on the contrary, yeah. Not a form of employment, not a job, but the idea of professing your allegiance to a group. So it's a pedantic point, but that is the same.
Well,
the same
I think it's
whole.
Important.
So it's
like a play on the word profess.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So to profess oneself as a proletarian is to say I belong to this group. I profess my faith is the phrase that Rancière uses.
And also Filippo, if the second time he was asked the question, "What's your état? What's your estate?"
Yeah.
There were the three estates.
Right.
And now he's professing a new one, the proletariat.
And there were people in 1789 who talked about the fourth estate, precisely meaning that. So you see, and then Luke.
Yeah, to think about this, because then there's still, there are people like Blanqui who can profess to be proletarians, but then there are common people outside Paris who are proletarian, but both are kind of included in the idea of the people or the proletariat. So there is like the passive objective.
Of course,
category, and then there's the. But yeah, then and yeah, that for Rancière that would be obviously the problem.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's the group as inclusive, but perhaps unconsciously aware of their situation, and then those who are conscious and aware of their status and their political affiliations and that's, as you say, to the point at which...
To what extent are they the same then? And to what extent are they the proletariat of the people? Like, because only the one part is able to kind of consciously choose to be it, and the other part is just belongs to it without knowing.
I think that's part of the problem of his thought, in a sense.
But Rancière has the same problem, and it's they're divided by education. So everyone is educatable, but you still have to educate yourself or find a way to be educated or re-educated or de-miseducated or something like that. But in Rancière, it's the same. You have to de-brutalize yourself, remember? Like, or abruti... Blanqui also uses the term, Jacques Cousteau too, of abrutissement. You know, we've been abruti. Hard to translate, by the way, in English properly, but, you know, stultified or literally reduced to the state of a beast because of all this miseducation. That's it. It doesn't say anything about people's capacities or position, even. It's just the fact of, hundreds of years of indoctrination. But if you can remove, and that has to be removed and dealt with, to pretend otherwise, this is the point that Dominique made, and it's important, again, Blanqui's criticized for this. He says, in 1848, we mustn't rush to premature elections. We mustn't have elections tomorrow because basically Napoleon's going to get elected. That's what's going to happen, the equivalent. Because, you know, we have to take a moment to level the playing field. And then he'll say later, well, they've had, the counter-revolutionaries have had 70 years, so in other words, since 1789, to mess with people. We need 70 years now to be able to open people's minds. And then there is no distinction. So political education is the dividing line. It's not a sociological thing, though. It's just that, I think.
I think I would tend to agree that often the distinction in Blanqui is pretty sharp, maybe too sharp.
Yeah.
Which is what I found funny about Rancière's engagement with him, because the notion of the kind of presumption of equality is like the antithesis of what everything Bob stands for in many ways. There's no kind of intellectual equality amongst them. That's the precise issue that needs to be reckoned with.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he is very scornful of people that he sees as kind of benighted peasants living in the sticks, you know, living in Bas-Bretagne, for example. He's not a federalist at all in that sense.
So I suppose this is connected to this idea of professing to be part of the proletariat. I was wondering, I noticed that when he's in the addresses to the society, it's always the terms that he uses, usually citizens, and I was just wondering if there's any sort of significance to the way that he'll shift to citizen rather than discussing, addressing the proletariat or whoever else it might be. Who are the members of the societies generally?
They're the kind of hand-picked membership who are adequately... You're talking about the secret society?
Yeah, well, I just read some of the addresses and, mm-hmm. and they're always citizens, and the terms used are usually citizens rather than proletariat. I was wondering...
I think that it's hard to pin down exactly when he uses certain terms and for what reason, right?
Yeah.
There's a certain kind of fluidity between them.
But does he use citizens to address them?
Because
citizen is the revolutionary
that's
form of address.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. But there's also, within the addresses, I felt that sometimes he would tend to not use the word proletarian so much, or when it wasn't a form of address, but merely referring to the revolutionary subject or class.
Mm-hmm.
I can't quite remember. I've just briefly looked through them yesterday, so maybe this is not significant.
Oh, I think it is. I think that for him to go from citoyen, you know, the call to citizens rise up or something, citoyen aux armes, is for him a way of addressing people in their capacity to act. And for him, I think, to be able to say that the proletariat is another way of describing citizens. I mean, I don't know if he ever makes the connection directly, but it would be important that they could be coordinated.
At that time,
same for Marx.
The word citizen had kept its revolutionary
connotation.
Mood.
Mm. Yeah.
Today, completely disappeared.
Yeah.
Autopie citoyenne, bourgeoisie.
Yeah.
Exactly. If you look at the minutes of the First International, it's always citizen Marx, citizen Bakunin.
Yeah.
As others have said, you know, citizen is the revolutionary term, and so is republican. They are the true representative of the nation, whereas he makes it clear, like, the royalists, the bourgeoisie, they're alien.
Yeah.
They're against the nation. The true people of the nation are the proletariat, who are also republicans and also citizens. There's a certain conflation at times,
mm-hmm.
and it's probably intentional.
Yeah. He doesn't use the word camarade, though, very much. Never, right?
No.
And that's an interesting distinction. Ah, okay. His brother does, apparently. That's funny.
Come out perhaps later.
Yeah.
Yes.
20th century, no?
Yeah.
Is that right? Not before? Anybody know?
Not
when,
longer with
the
before.
Citizen.
Not a long time before.
Everybody was citizen. And
yeah.
It's also, and I think that, you know, on Shashti Diakata herself, it really is something that I assume that Marissa might be speaking about this afternoon, or I will be. That it's all part of the continuation of the revolution.
Yes.
And so, aux armes citoyens.
Yes.
So, calling somebody citizen is also a way of connecting up the struggles of 1848 or 1830 or 1832 with 1792, which is really, you know, 92 and 93 are the years for the long key.
That's right. And they're years of victory, and it's
the
essential to remember.
Victory, exactly.
We won, we can win again. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Tullian.
I've got two quite different questions. The first one is that, coming to Blanqui for the first time, it's easy to see why one would be interested in points of contact and points of difference with Marx. But is there any evidence of an actual contact, or at least awareness of each other's writings and works? That's the first question.
Mm-hmm.
Second question is, I was very interested to hear that Blanqui was interested in questions of free will and determinism. And of course, in the 19th century, there was a big debate following on for the work of Castellet and his treatise on the development of manliness faculties on so-called statistical fatalism. And I wondered if Blanqui noted that or contributed to it in the text that was mentioned in your original.
Yeah, just to answer that quickly, not that off the top of my head, I don't remember that, but the positivists are what he's going after, mm-hmm. and the idea that that basically there's this irresistible tendency in that work in history that you can that serves as a retrospective justification of what's happened, and people who say, well, governments, you know, can't really do anything, we just have to kind of go with the flow. But there's no alternative. I mean, it's basically that kind of criticism. Or that the movement of commerce, if you go back to, say, Montesquieu and others, that the movement of commerce and the development of liberal freedoms and so on, that this is kind of the ineluctable movement of history. I mean, he does have a notion of progress of a kind because he believes in education. Cumulative education is indeed progressive, but only because it gives people a chance to determine their own fate, to make their own history, basically. On the first point, so la question était le rapport entre Marx et Blanqui. Est-ce qu'il y avait un rapport direct, donc est-ce que Blanqui s'engageait vraiment avec Marx et le contraire ou pas?
Alors,
c'est que le principe.
Oui. il existe des lettres entre Marx et Blanqui. Elles ne sont pas toutes éditées. Elles ne sont pas toutes. Elles ne sont pas toutes collectées et mises en relation les unes avec les autres. Je n'ai pas non plus eu le temps de le faire.
So there are some letters between Marx and Blanqui, but they're not really connected. No one's done the editorial work. The only person who could do it is sitting next to me, but she hasn't had time yet.
Il y a des relations par Lafargue aussi.
And then Paul Lafargue, so Marx is now son-in-law. That's right. Knew Blanqui directly and tried to arrange a meeting.
Et ce dont je suis à peu près certaine, c'est qu'il n'y a pas d'échange théorique entre Marx et Blanqui.
But there's no real theoretical exchange as far as you know.
Il n'y a pas de lettres, il n'y a pas de documents bien explicites. Les lettres qui existent, dans mon souvenir, sont simplement, je dirais, davantage des lettres de politesse, entre guillemets.
Yeah, the letters that exist are mostly kind of cordialities or exchanges of politeness. There's no real theoretical interchange. There's one, I can think of one tiny reference where he refers to a review, do you remember, of Capital, a critical review, and he's clearly critical of the criticism, but he doesn't, frustratingly, a lot of his notes are a bit like blog entries. Like he'll write something out of a newspaper that he's read, or in this case a review, and often then will add a little commentary, sort of, can you believe this, or something like that. But frustratingly, he doesn't go into any detail. I don't think there's any evidence that he read Capital, for example.
J'oublie aussi le rôle de Rank. Certainement que Rank a pris des contacts au nom de Blanqui.
And then Rank, yeah, so some of the people in the Blanqui's exile circles, there were attempts to arrange some kind of meeting. There was even talk that maybe Blanqui went over in 1850 to London, but at some point to London, but then there's no evidence that he ever did that. Do you know of anything else?
Well, I believe Blanqui read The Poverty of Philosophy, which was directed against Proudhon.
Yes.
He didn't like at that point, and said favorable things about it. And there is a reference, I believe, in Hal Draper's third volume of his Marx, where Blanqui was staying with a member of a Marxist, like what would be the Socialist Party, and that person was trying to get hear what Blanqui thought of Marx and just kind of scoffed at it.
Yes.
And there was talk, Lafargue may have been playing Marx up, you know, saying that Blanqui thinks very well of you, you know.
That's
exaggerating.
Well, there's like three, in Marx itself, there's about three or four references to Blanqui, and they're mostly, I mean, they're often positive. Engels is very critical, and or generally, so after the Commune, also after 1848, the idea of a kind of putschist. You know, that's where a lot of that.
Personally, you know, as a dedicated revolutionary, not thinking very much of his style of organization.
Right.
Which is, at one point, Marx says when Blanqui's in, being put on trial in the 1850s or 60s, this man is the heart and soul of the proletarian movement in France.
Yes, but he's also a bit of an alchemist of the revolution,
yes,
right?
Yes, and the alchemist of the revolution.
That's it, yeah. Let me just see, was there any other question from. Anybody else? First? No? Okay.
Do any of the speakers know what kind of economist his brother was? That is, like, sort of what tradition he comes out of? Is it something more like French-based, like the physiocratic tradition? Or is it, you know, straight through, like, the Scottish Enlightenment, like the traditional classical guys, like Smith and Ricardo?
I have no idea, but, alors, le frère, c'était oui. Quel genre d'économiste?
Il y a une étude qui a été faite par Francis Démier sur l'économie, le frère de sur Adolphe Blanqui. C'est un économiste que Blanqui classe comme libéral et qui n'intéresse pas ce titre, vraiment.
Tradition Jean-Baptiste Say.
Oui, voilà, tout à fait.
So Jean-Baptiste Say,
ah, okay.
French liberal tradition. There is a study done, I didn't catch the name, but of him, and you could find it. You can find all of Adolphe Blanqui's work in the Gallica collection of the BNF, if you can read the French. And there's quite it's substantial a body of work, but he was a prominent figure.
Alors, ce que je voulais dire, juste une petite chose encore sur l'économie qui nous a, la question sur l'économie qui nous a été posée là.
Mm-hmm.
Signaler simplement que Blanqui, c'est vrai qu'il n'écrit pas sur l'économie lui-même, qu'il y a ce conflit avec son frère, mais j'ai vu dans les archives, que dans les lettres qu'il écrit, les différents documents, en fait, il donne des cours d'économie quand il est en prison. Parce qu'il fait de l'éducation aussi en prison.
Uh-huh.
Avec tous ceux qui sont emprisonnés avec lui.
À Belle-Île.
À Saint-Michel aussi, je crois. Et donc, ils se réunissent et ils donnent des cours. Et ils donnent des cours d'économie. Mais malheureusement, nous ne les avons pas. Nous n'avons pas grand-chose là-dessus.
Okay, so
mais l'économie l'intéressait visiblement.
Yeah.
Mais il n'en a pas. Voilà.
Okay, I think to add then, so he's clearly interested in the economy and economics because when he's in prison, he taught economics courses to fellow prisoners, both at Saint-Michel, so that's after 1839, and then maybe particularly at Belle-Île after 1848. And so it's a question that he paid attention to, that he was informed about. By the way, it's something also that Dominique herself does these days, so to say, another point of common contact between the two of you. Yes, but then the course notes, unfortunately, themselves are again missing, were burned. So we don't have that resource. Maybe one last question, and then we'll pause, or if you stop here. Yeah, go ahead.
I was wondering about the category or concept of education in Blanqui.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not really familiar with his works, so I'm wondering how he sees education, or how he conceives education. Is it a kind of top-down form of education that is brought by the landlord, or cultural formation?
Yes. Donc, question, c'est à propos de comment il concevait l'éducation, de quelle manière, est-ce que c'était une éducation culturelle, plutôt traditionnelle, ou d'en haut, avec un enseignant qui fait des cours aux jeunes ou...
Il n'y a aucune indication, aucun programme. C'est bien la particularité de Blanqui, c'est de ne pas faire de programme.
Right, there's no program. One of the characteristic things about Blanqui is that he doesn't spell things out, he doesn't lay down a blueprint or a program in advance.
Ni pour les nouvelles sociétés, ni pour l'éducation.
Yeah. Neither for the society to come, nor for education as a program. What he does seem to often use the term instruction, éducation, instruction, where it's pretty clear that what he means is something like traditional school, where you teach the basic, you teach basics, math, science, classical stuff, as history. He himself was very versed in the classics, and in many ways is a classicist. So I think that would have been important too. You can get, negatively, you can see what he really hates, though, which is catechism, learning by rote, internalization of authority and superstition, doing what you're told. So.
Et peut-être que les programmes, la question des programmes se posait moins à cette époque-là, où le programme minimal, c'était quand même de savoir lire et écrire.
Yeah.
Où l'analphabétisme était quand même très important.
And perhaps the question of a more precise program was less important at the time, where the key question was, can you read or not? Literacy being still quite limited and so on. So I think of it as a little bit like the beginning of the Cuban Revolution, for example, where one of the immediate priority is let's have a mass literacy drive. And I think Blanqui would have been enthusiastic about that kind of thing. That's the point of departure. He's also very much a person who follows in the line of the Enlightenment. So I think in many ways he would have had, he admired very much the more materialist atheist figures of the Enlightenment, and he would have probably continued with them in that sense. Okay, well, thank you very much. That was a great start of the day. Thank you very much for our speakers. So we have a literally 5-minute break, and then we'll be right back here with Eric Gazan. Okay. Just around the corner, you'll find them.